Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. As always, I'm Eddie Mayfield, your host, and we're glad that you're here. We have a great show today, a very timely show. The big news this week in the news world was the Hobby Lobby ruling. We have an expert on with us today from the Liberty Institute, their chief counsel, Jeremy Dice. Jeremy, welcome to Driven to Business.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Jeremy, I guess since it's all the news this week, tell us, and I know you've probably been inundated with requests for interviews on this, talk to us about the Hobby Lobby decision, what it means, what it doesn't mean.
Well, it is a landmark decision for the freedom of conscience rights of every American, including business owners, that now recognize that they are free to live and work according to their beliefs without fear of their government. The Supreme Court has now recognized in their decision that citizens cannot be forced to choose between violating their faith and being punished by the government for following their faith. That's an important matter, especially for those that are choosing to enter into the marketplace through the corporate form. The Supreme Court has said, look, when you go into the boardroom or into the corner office, you're not shedding your First Amendment freedoms. In fact, you cannot be coerced into shedding your First Amendment freedoms. You still retain those rights even when you're in business. That's a great decision. We should be very thankful for it.
Is it surprising to you that it was such a narrow decision? And I know it carries the same force of law regardless of where 9 vote for it or 5 vote for it. But is it surprising to you that it was a narrow decision?
I think most people expected it to be a 5-4 decision, at least most in the legal community, us lawyer geeks who are watching the court so hawkishly, expected it to be a 5-4 split. But any day that Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg says that this is a decision with substantial breadth to it in regards to religious liberty, I think I'm happy. So when Justice Alito writes, and this is a great quote for those that are in business today, a corporation is simply a form of organization used by human beings to achieve desired ends. In other words, when you go into a corporation, you don't have to be a sole proprietor or anything like that to retain your religious liberty rights. You still get to retain your First Amendment freedoms when you go into the corporate form and receive the protections that the corporate form provides for that mom-and-pop grocery store that protects them against a slip and fall on aisle 4. You still receive that right as a closely held business in anything that you do related to religious liberty. So it's a broad decision for religious liberty, but it's also a narrow decision by its vote, but narrowly applied to just this contraceptive mandate element. We'll see how else it gets picked up in the other elements of business and religious liberty.
You know, as a small business owner, I was thrilled to see this come down because I had wondered what this means for me if they vote the other way. And as a person of conscience, then you have to decide, what am I going to do about this? Am I going to engage in civil disobedience, or what am I going to do if I'm asked to do something that I think is morally repugnant to me as a Christian? And I'm very glad to see this. You know, I guess one thing, again, us non-lawyers, explain to us, it seems like on its face that we should never have had to endure a case like this, that it should never have happened in the first place. I know there's a Liberty Institute. You guys spend a lot of your time, if not all of your time, defending religious liberty. So tell us about that. What are you guys all about?
Well, Liberty Institute is dedicated to advancing and defending religious liberty according to the vision that our founding fathers laid out for us. So I guess defending religious liberty is only about half of what we do. We also turn it around and go on the offense as often as we possibly can. Sometimes your best offense, as they say, is a great defense. And so we're playing both those sides of the coin anywhere we go. But the reality is this, is that religious liberty in America has come under some substantial threats over the last couple of years. And it seems to be growing every year. In fact, we do an annual survey of religious hostility in America. And last year's edition of that, so surveying the year 2012, we documented over 1,300 instances of religious hostility in America. So it's a remarkable decision. It's a remarkable things that are going on today. Unfortunately, the business of religious liberty defense is booming right now.
Right.
But gratefully, we've got groups like Liberty Institute out there that when we get involved in these cases, over 9 out of 10, we win.
You know, it is a little scary if you stop and think about it for a moment, and I'm sure you do, that it only would have taken another vote on the Supreme Court, and this case would have been lost. And it to me, that just, and I know, as you'd put it, you geek lawyers, I wouldn't use that term, of course, but that you guys that follow the court expected it. But in an overall sense, the fact that we are under such, that freedoms are under such assault, as religious freedoms are under such assault, that you even have to go through a case like that, and that it's narrowly decided. You guys have been involved in some very interesting cases, and you've had a lot of success. You know, first of all, I heard a speech by your CEO a few weeks ago, and I was interested in your methods. You're a little different than some of the other, and this is not knocking anybody else, but you're a little different in the way some of the other organizations that defend religious liberty defend cases, in that you use not always your own lawyers. Tell us about that.
No, look, we think that there's enough work to go around, for one thing, but we think that the defense of religious liberty is a lot of fun. You know, we don't want to hog all the fun to ourselves. There are attorneys that go their whole lives without being able to see the inside of a courtroom because they're engaged in transactional law, and yet they're just passionate about the defense of religious liberty. And so what we have done, look, we weren't smart enough to come up with this on our own. We looked across the aisle and saw that the American Civil Liberties Union were trying to get some of the best attorneys in the country to do their cases. And we said, hey, look, we've got even better attorneys at those same law firms that will do the work on our side of the case here, too. And so we picked up their model, employed it in our own side of things, and you know what? We started beating the ACLU anytime we showed up against them. And that continues to today. So what we do, here's how our model is different. We go to some of the biggest firms in the country. So these are firms that they're on the back of your Yellow Pages. They're the firms that have offices all over the country, in Shanghai and Hong Kong and Switzerland and everywhere else. These are major multinational law firms that have really high-credentialed attorneys inside their firms that are just eager for a chance to do something, you know, out of the ordinary of defending Fortune 500 companies, something that will provide them with some meaning. And we get to scratch that itch. We get to provide them with an opportunity to come into the defense of people who are trying to exercise their freedom of religion in this country. And the benefit that we get out of it is that, we win. And so it's a great combination to be able to use people that are being able to fulfill their passions in life and to secure religious liberty for the men and women across this country who are trying to exercise it in the public square, in the church, in the schools, and even in our military.
You know, when I heard Kelly Shackelford talk about that, it seems so obvious that that's the way you would do it. That after he talked, but it really is, it's a remarkable way you guys do that. And like you say, you end up with some of the best litigators in the world, who are passionate about these issues, as passionate as any of us are, and we get them to get up there and fight these cases. Tell us, I'm going to spend a couple segments here actually talking about some of your cases because they're fascinating. Just pick one and tell us about it.
Well, one of my favorite recent cases has to do with a 5-year-old little girl down in Orlando, Florida, who was at school one day, and she was trying to say grace over her lunch. So she's got her mac and cheese or whatever it was in the school lunchroom. She sits down, and just like her parents taught her to do, she bows her head, folds her hands, closes her eyes, and tries to say grace over her lunch. And the teacher comes by and sees her doing this and says, hey, you can't pray. That's not good. You're not allowed to pray. And she says, but it is good to pray in school. And the teacher says, no, you're not allowed to do that at school. And this 5-year-old little girl is just filled with all kinds of pluck. And she says, no, but it is good. And she tries to do it again. And as it's recorded, you probably have seen this on YouTube, she says, but they caught me, and she wasn't able to finish her prayer. It just, you know, look, when we've gotten to the point where we have teachers trying to silence a 5-year-old little girl trying to say grace over her chicken nuggets and macaroni and cheese, we have really jumped the shark when it comes to religious liberty in this country. Of course students can pray while they're at school, and we continue to press that issue with Seminole County Schools down in Florida. We've gotten them to basically apologize for this issue, and we got a couple loose ends yet to tie up, but it's an important principle for us to stand up and say, of course a young girl can pray at school, and not only does the Constitution say she can, but the federal government Department of Education has said that she can pray while she's at school and over her lunch.
You know, why would either the teacher is an activist, an anti-religion activist, or she's just misinformed? Which do you think it is in cases like that?
You know, I think 90% of the time it is just that they have bought into this constant lying drumbeat that is out there that says you've got to maintain this so-called separation of church and state. That's just a myth. There is no such thing. The First Amendment clearly protects five-year-old little girls from praying in school. But you see, what happens is that the American Civil Liberties Union, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Freedom from Religion Foundation, etc., they come out there beating these potential lawsuits out there, and they get one or two lawsuits to win, or they get a couple of school districts to avoid litigation through a demand letter. And all of a sudden, they perpetuate this myth that if you mention anything at school having to do with your faith, or dare you close your eyes for just a shade too long, you're going to be in violation of the Constitution. And they create this really intimidating atmosphere. Well, that's unnecessary. And we're happy to come beside teachers, come beside administrations and students, and defend religious liberty. In fact, we've offered to several school districts to come in and train their teachers about what religious liberty actually means. We haven't had anybody take us up yet, but we continue to make the offer out there so that students and teachers can continue to be expressing their religious liberty while they're at school.
Jeremy, in the case of this little girl, in about a minute, did you actually have to file a suit on this, or was just calling and discussing it with them enough to resolve this issue?
Typically, sending a demand letter and explaining to them how they violated the Constitution will pretty quickly evoke an apology. We haven't had to go to a lawsuit, but they don't want us to go to a lawsuit, because when we get involved in the litigation, 9 times out of 10, we're going to win that case, and it's going to cost the taxpayers a lot of money to just simply uphold the First Amendment.
It does. You know, even I get confused sometimes, because it's like you said, if you just listen to the news, there's this continual drumbeat about, oh, you can't do that in a public square. You can't. We're always hearing somebody filing a lawsuit to take down a Christmas tree or something and say, oh, you can't have that in a public square. Oh, this pastor was going to speak at a graduation service, but he's been told he can't pray there. And we sort of just absorb that. And is it just a cultural thing? Is that it?
Well, I think so, but it's also people just don't like courtrooms. And I'm the lawyer geek that really likes to be inside of a courtroom. Anytime we think of being sued, it's just kind of a negative thing. But we've got to understand that we've been given these rights in a very privileged position in America to have a legal system that we can participate in to secure the rights that God has given to us. We need to stop viewing these as negative opportunities and viewing them instead as precious gifts given to us by God to be able to be a strong witness, not just for legal issues, but for the religious liberty that's been given to us as a gift.
Well, Jeremy, hang on during the break. I want to talk to you more about that. That's a fascinating subject, and I appreciate so much you being on the program today. You're listening to Driven to Business. By the way, we're streaming live on biz1190.com. Today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. More to come. Stick around. Welcome back to Driven to Business. Glad you're here. Our guest today is Jeremy Dice, Chief Counsel with the Liberty Institute. Very timely program today, given that this week the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby, when a lot of you have been following that in the news. Jeremy, we talked about the little girl that was told not to pray at school. You guys have got some other interesting and very recent cases you've been involved in. Tell us about those.
Yeah, our most recent case comes out of California, just about 2 hours east of San Diego, in a little desert town where Brooks Hamby, who was the salutatorian, so the number two guy in his class, graduating at Brawley Union High School, he won the right to be able to give a speech to his peers, and he wanted it to reflect who he was. He wanted it to talk about his faith in his salutatorian or his address to his students. Well, he had to submit his speech. He did, and they sent it back and say, no, this is too religious. You got to tone it down. So he tried to tone it down a little bit and sent it back a second time, and the school official said, no, this is too religious. You still can't do it this way. Give us a third one. Did it a third time, and this time it didn't come back with instructions. It came back with big black lines drawn through any reference to faith or God or Jesus or anything like that. It was like this was some sort of national secret document that they had to put these black lines over to make sure they didn't give any secrets away to the Chinese or something. So he went into the graduation that night. This was the night after receiving these black lines that afternoon. he went to the graduation speech, and he gave the speech anyway, and in it he referenced his faith, and he said, look, I was told three times during the lead-up to this graduation that I wasn't supposed to address my faith. Well, I'm going to do it anyway, and proceeded to bless these students in the name of God of the Bible and that sort of thing. We've sent a letter to the Union, Raleigh Union High School, explaining to them what the religious liberty rights are, and essentially saying, look, when a student earns the right to address his peers at graduation, the school's response is to listen to the speech, not try to censor it. And the fact that they tried to censor this three different times is just terribly outrageous, and I can't believe we've actually got to get involved to try to exonerate this young man who did the right thing in addressing his peers.
I guess that's what still angers me a bit, is why in the world that you have to get a lawyer involved, and I'm not knocking lawyers, I'm glad you guys are there, and I'm glad you got involved, but just the very idea that that people who are supposedly educated because they're educating other people know so little about our rights in this country that they would just assume you could tell somebody, oh, you can't mention the word God.
And it's specifically more surprising given the fact that they actually sent a letter back with the third blacked out revision of his speech that said our lawyers have said that this is a violation of the Constitution. And that's why we've edited it like this. Well, it surprises me that the lawyers would say that kind of thing. This is private speech. This wasn't the school trying to speak. This wasn't the government trying to give a message to everybody there gathered. This was the speech of a young man who had earned the right to address his peers. And this young man's only high school graduation is now going to have this pall hanging over it for the rest of his life because some uppity attorney, school board attorney, decided to say, no, I don't like the mention of Jesus in this one. We've got to scratch this one off here and there. Now, when a student earns the right to address his peers, the school needs to listen. And I should also mention quickly that if you are a student and you come up against this kind of thing across this country, let me give you this piece of advice. Never listen to a school board attorney who is intent on censoring your speech. Always give Liberty Institute a call to make sure that you have the right to engage in your First Amendment expression at school.
Yeah, give us your web. It's libertyinstitute.org. Is that correct?
Libertyinstitute.org will get you to us, and you can even reach out to us with your case there and submit it for our review.
And by the way, there will also be on eddiemayfield.com. If you go to my site, the show site, then go to the blog site, there will be contact information and the website for Liberty Institute. So go there and check that out. Jeremy, it seems some of this seems so illogical when we look around and we see that life, and I know this is a trite thing, but on our coins it says "In God We Trust." So if we've got that on our coins, how can it be that, how can anyone think that you can't say God during a speech at school? I don't understand the logic of that.
Well, at the same time, the First Amendment starts with the words, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or respecting the free exercise thereof.
Right.
And what do you know? We create the Affordable Care Act that we find out this week. The Supreme Court says you, Congress, have substantially burdened the free exercise of religion. And so I guess if it's good for the In God We Trust on the coins, it's good for the Supreme Court case here, too. The reality is this, is that there's always going to be a contingent in this country, as there was at our founding, to try to pare down religious liberty in this country. But we've got to understand that freedom and liberty, especially religious liberty, that undergirds the very freedoms that we have here, they're only one generation away from being removed. So if our generation does not stand up and say, no, I know what religious liberty means and what it stands for, and I'm going to assert those rights graciously and firmly, we may lose those freedoms if we are not going to stand up for them.
I make the point very often that just as a business guy and having done business in some other countries, I won't name them, where there's sort of not a moral underpinning to business. Now, Jeremy, what I mean by that is, you know, here in this country, if you're selling your lawnmower, and I don't know you very well, but I assume if we discuss your lawnmower and you tell me you'll sell me the lawnmower for $300, and I say okay, and you say it does this and does that, and I come get the lawnmower and give you $300. Well, you give me that lawnmower that we talked about, not another one. And we don't have to get a lawyer involved in that or anything of that sort. because there's sort of an underlying morality there the values just say, hey, that's not right. You got to do what you said you do. And, you know, most business, I know this may have come as a surprise to some of you attorneys, most of us do most of our business without getting an attorney involved. Most of the time we just work it out. And if it's a disagreement, we just work it out with the customer and that all happens. But, you know, when you take an attack on religious liberties is an attack on that too. Because if you take that out where that if we don't have the freedom to practice religion, well, maybe I don't have the freedom to criticize the government, or maybe I don't have the freedom to marry who I want to, or maybe I don't have the freedom to travel to New York if I want to. I think it's all tied together. And I know you guys have that opinion there at the Liberty Institute that it's not just about religion.
Well, look, John Adams, our second president, said that our Constitution was made for a religious people. It
right.
is wholly inadequate to the governance of any other.
Absolutely.
If the president of the United States or one of our dearest founding fathers believed that is the case, then it is incumbent upon each of us to consider precisely what that means. And, you know, it's important for each of us to continue to defend that right to religious liberty, because if we disregard that, we're going to lose that privilege very quickly. What the government did not give to us was religious liberty. That was given to us by God.
Right.
We did not give that over to government to be able to manage, but they seek to somehow get in there and remove what we did not give to them to do. And so it's up to us as people who love that religious liberty, people of faith who believe that it was given to us by God, and therefore it is a gift we must steward and protect, to make sure that we are constantly in the defense of religious liberty, lest we lose it. You know, as it concerns the Affordable Care Act, it's an interesting kind of correlation there, given the court's ruling this week on that matter, because at no point did the Department of Justice ever argue that business leaders had to give up their faith when it came to decisions regarding ethics, right? So there was
right.
no question that a Christian businessman, for instance, couldn't employ his faith that informs him on the issue of embezzlement. He knew
right.
that it was wrong to embezzle because of his faith.
Right.
Well, now when it comes to the issue of conscience, the federal government says, no, you've got to change your opinion and conform to us. Well, the Supreme Court today has said, that's not going to be the case any longer.
Thank goodness they did come out and say that. You know, I was thinking while you were talking a while ago, and I guess I'm a typical non-lawyer person, just sort of, you know, I'm a Christian, I run a business, and I go through life that way. You know, we make these assumptions sometimes. I think we fall over in this philosophy that if the government hasn't said it's legal, it must be illegal. But actually, that's a complete reversal of the founding of our country, where it's the government that's limited by the Constitution, not us. It's our rights come from God. The governments come from us. You're listening to Driven to Business. We're talking with Jeremy Dice, the chief counsel for the Liberty Institute, which you can find at libertyinstitute.org. This is Driven to Business. We're streaming live on biz1190.com, podcast on eddiemayfield.com, and we'll be back in just a moment. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Driven to Business. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're talking with Jeremy Dice, the chief counsel for the Liberty Institute. Jeremy, you guys have had so many cases going on. You mentioned to us earlier that that you've documented, I think you said 1,300 attacks on religious liberty. It's like a lot of us are unaware of that. Talk to us about the gentleman, I think his name is Philip Monk, Sergeant Monk, in the case you guys are involved with.
Yeah, and before I do, let me just urge you to go to libertyinstitute.org and download a copy of that survey for yourself. We're going to have a new one come out this fall, but you can download a copy of, we call it Undeniable, our survey of religious hostility in America for 2013. But it's right on our website at libertyinstitute.org, and if you want to print it out, it's like an inch and a half thick, so just make sure you have enough paper in your printer. But you know, send us an email, and we'll send you a bound copy of it for you instead. But here's the deal with Sergeant Monk. Sergeant Monk was a master sergeant in the U.S. Air Force, and he was 19 and a half years in, I believe. And the master sergeant for that specific outfit is the highest non-commissioned officer in the Air Force. And so
right.
he was he was the head dude for all the soldiers there, the airmen there on his base. Well, he had a commanding officer who was a lesbian, and at some point it came up in a discussion about something, about the issue of marriage. And Sergeant Monk, who's a professing Christian and a very faithful one, he said, look, Commander, I cannot agree with you on this point, and if you're asking me to make that decision, I simply cannot do it, and I'm asking for an accommodation for my faith. And this CO just got angry. And basically, in civilian terms, she fired him. So he was moved along early to the next assignment, but that, in our parlance, would be firing this 19-and-a-half-year veteran, combat veteran and everything. And this guy could have just simply rolled with it. I mean, he could have just rolled over and said, okay, fine, I'll agree with you. I got to protect my pension, my kids, and things like that. I'm 19 and a half years in. Have 6 more months, and I'll be able to vest my pension and retire with the pension that this country is proud to give to him. But at dinner time, he's looking across the table at his sons, and he said, what message does it send to my kids if I don't stand up for religious liberty in this case right now? And he had to assert his rights. Well, let me tell you the fast-forward end of that story that just happened a couple months ago. We came into the defense of Sergeant Monk, and we defend several of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines at Liberty Institute. And we came in the defense of him, took this case, and shone the light on it that we needed to, file the right case work that we needed to file in his defense. He has now vested his 20 years in the military. He's got his pension. And not only did we get an apology from the Department of Defense, you know what else? They gave him a medal.
Wow.
So he was due a certain medal. They could have taken that away, but he received the medal that he was deserving of. And we have been glad to stand with airmen like Master Sergeant Monk for his defense of religious liberty in the United States Air Force.
You know, we hear rumors all the time now about how that that even chaplains in the military are being told to do things that are and I don't know if these are just anecdotal stories or if they're or if they're and just somebody made up or if they're factual, but where chaplains are actually being told to do things that are in violation of their faith and again, I guess the point is these attacks you talk about and hostility extends through the culture right into the military, and this is Sergeant Monk's a great example of that.
Well, it's no coincidence that they would target the United States military as the means to challenge religious liberty. They are kind of the microcosm for our entire culture, as goes the military and the esprit de corps that we find in there, so goes the entire fabric of our country. And even more so in the military, where it is such a structured, top-down hierarchy, it is necessary, as our recent experiences in Nazi Germany remind us, to have moral leaders at the very top of the helm. And so if they can undermine that kind of moral leadership, then is going to be greater problems not only through the military but through our country as well. I'm glad for my colleague, Mike Berry, who heads up our military affairs efforts. Mike is a veteran of the Marine Corps, JAG Corps in specific.
Right.
If we're going to have anybody defending religious liberty in this country, I'm really glad that it's a Marine Corps veteran.
Yeah, that sounds great. I like to have a Marine defending me, too. That sounds awesome. Let me ask you, just in general, there are people listening, I'm sure, that are not particularly religious and may not have a religious background. Why should they care about attacks on religious liberties?
Yeah, if we lose religious liberty, we lose the underpinnings of our entire freedom in this country. So the freedom to engage in life according to the dictates of our own faith, we lose that. And the freedom to be able to learn about various things in according with our own faith, we lose that as well. We lose the right to do business on that point as well. Religious liberty is the moral center by which we undergird all of our freedoms in general. If we lose that, we lose a great amount of things. Defending that very first freedom that the Founding Fathers decided should go at the very top of those Bill of Rights, it becomes a very, very important matter for us as citizens of this country.
Jeremy, just as a practical matter, I should say, for those of us that are Christians and run businesses, what should we not do because of the fact that we're Christians? I'm talking about in dealing with your employees and dealing with primarily, I guess, in dealing with your employees. What are the things that we should not do as a Christian?
I'm reminded of the theologian who was being talked to about his particular brand of theology, and he said, "Yeah, I am that brand of theology, but I'm not angry about it." that's good advice for us in general. Is that my immediate thought when he asked me that question was to say, "Well, don't be a jerk about it."
You're right.
Engage your faith when you're at work. You've got the freedom to do so, but don't be a jerk about the whole thing. We've been given these freedoms by God, and we ought to be humbled by that fact. But we also ought to be good stewards of the gift that we've been given to us, not only from the legal perspective, but also in the practical outworking of our faith, that we ought to be very humble reflectors of Christ, if that is the faith that you follow, that we ought to be a pleasant aroma to those around of us that would seek to give off more of Christ than to put people away. So, be a faithful follower of Christ in the workplace, but don't cause a stink about it all. But if your rights are circumvented and if your rights are questioned, and give us a call. It doesn't mean that we're going to go into courtroom that day, but it may mean that we have an opportunity to keep the door open for the gospel, even in your cubicle.
Exactly. I'm on a sister station of WAFS Biz 1190 here is 9:20 a.m. here in town. It's part of Salem, and one of their afternoon person is Dennis Prager, who's a wonderful talk show host. And Dennis is Jewish, but I heard him say one time on the air that he was talking about that. And he said, why wouldn't anyone want to live next door to a devout Christian? He said, someone that thinks you should do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Someone who says someone who has been told to love his neighbor more than himself. Someone who's been told not to cheat people, not to lie to people. To be honorable in his dealings. Someone who's been told to be humble. I think what you're talking about. I have been around, and you have too, I'm sure, Christians who do perhaps wear it on their sleeve a bit too much, and almost are. I like that quote you said, who are almost angry about being Christians. That's a ridiculous situation.
Yeah, it's easy to get that way because of all these instances of religious hostility that we see in America today, and a federal government that seems particularly intent on limiting your right to engage in the free exercise of your faith, especially at work. But here's the reality, and this is a good civics lesson for all of us, is that our Constitution is divided into basically two halves. You've got the Constitution proper and then the Bill of Rights that follow after that. Well, if you were to draw a dividing line right above the First Amendment, it's basically our way as a country of saying, look, we don't have the ability to do all these things, and yet we are given these rights by our creation. So we're going to give them to a central form of government to be able to lay taxes, to be able to form a military so that we can defend our freedoms in our country here. We can't raise an army on our own. We're going to have government do that.
Right.
But we're only going to give you a certain amount of rights. Everything below this line, starting at the First Amendment on the way down, we didn't give you those rights. Those belong to us.
Right.
And I find it very interesting and I think important that the First Amendment is the very first of the amendments, that the Founding Fathers said, we did not give you government the right to establish religion or to prevent our free exercise thereof. And therefore, if you try to do that, if you do anything but remain neutral or tell us how to engage our faith, then we're going to be able to employ all these other rights that we might have, the right to petition our government through the redress of government in the court or through the political atmosphere. We're going to say, no, we didn't give you those rights. You are taking those rights. And not only are you taking them from us, you are acting as God himself, because the only person who did give us those rights is God himself. Government, you're not God. You don't get to play God. Those belong to us because they're given to us by God. Don't take them.
That's why I'm so happy for an organization like Liberty Institute and other organizations like you, that I think that message that you just gave right there gets so lost in the culture now, where somehow, although if you ask anyone with any kind of education on an intellectual basis, do your rights come from the government, from God, they would probably not say from the government, but we live as if they do. And every time there's a problem in society, we want the government to step in and make another law to do something about it. Our state representative here in town is a great guy, and I was kidding him on a post the other day on Facebook. He was talking about how many laws he had passed in the last legislative session. I said, well, how many did you repeal? Because there was a bunch of people kind of getting in, because we seem to have a lot of laws already, and we're keeping trying to come up with them. Hey, I want to finish this probably after the break, but I, as far as a setup on it, there is so much confusion with a lot of us about the Establishment Clause. And I sent you a note about this, Jeremy, and I actually made a little Freudian slip myself. I said the separation clause because I'm as brainwashed as everybody else is about that. But the establishment clause in the U.S. Constitution, what it actually means, and perhaps more importantly, what it doesn't mean. For about a minute, can you start on that? We'll finish it after the break.
Yeah, I think I can. And that just goes back to this constant drumbeat that we've had for the last half of a century or so of some groups that are really intent on limiting your religious liberty that have said that there is this so-called separation of church and state that's out there. Well, there isn't, and I'll give you a dollar if you can find those words in the Constitution. That just doesn't exist. What we do have is the intentional restriction upon government preventing them from establishing religion or from prohibiting our free exercise thereof. And maybe that's where we can leave it and pick it up after the break. But the point is this, that government doesn't get to decide how we live, learn, and do business according to our faith. That has been given to us by God, not by government. And we ought to be able to retain that.
But there is, as you know, an unbelievable amount of confusion about this. And just even reading what some supposedly intelligent people write when they, you know, and they'll write down about Hobby Lobby means that we're establishing a theocracy or something. I just read that today, and it's like, well, that's just nuts. How in the world do you get that out of that? It's just crazy. You're listening to Driven to Business. Let me remind you that we are streaming live on biz1190.com. We're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on Atlanta's business radio, biz1190.com. I am Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the final segment of today's Driven to Business. Very interesting program today with Jeremy Dice, the chief counsel with the Liberty Institute. You can find Jeremy's organization at libertyinstitute.org. Go there and check that out. Great website. Tells you a lot about the things that they are involved in. Jeremy, before the break, you were giving us a quick rundown on the Establishment Clause and what it doesn't mean. I know the word separation of church and state came from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to a church who was concerned about this new government and what they were going to do. But you see, that term is used all the time, even by courts, the separation of church and state. How did that get started?
Well, I got to confess right up front that most attorneys still are trying to battle through what the Establishment Clause actually means. In fact, our Supreme Court has really not given us a whole lot of guidance probably right in the last 30 years as to what the Establishment Clause is all about. We're really confused, and we're hoping that there will be a few decisions here shortly that will give some clarity to that. In fact, we did receive one earlier this year in the Greece versus Galloway case that you may have read about, where the Supreme Court pointed to our history in this country of having this long-held history of opening public meetings with prayer. And in that, they said, look, we're a country that historically values this type of opportunity and historically gives people the freedom to speak according to their own faith, and we don't prohibit that. And so we're going to continue to honor that great gift. And so these private speakers get up now before the town council meetings or even the openings of our Congress or local representative meetings and offer a prayer that is the speech of that individual person and not that of the government. That's a great thing and a good thing to recognize. But, you know, this confusion with the separation of church and state does go back to that letter that Thomas Jefferson put into place. And if there's been a wall that's been created between church and state, it's been a wall that is meant to protect the church and not the state itself.
Exactly, right.
That there has been an influencing that the government has expected really from the time government, and not just our own American government, but government in general was established, that the church would in fact influence the state. And that's a necessary and notable thing. As I mentioned earlier, John Adams said, our Constitution was created for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the governance of any other.
Right.
And so we expect in our country for citizens to influence our government with the morality that they bring with them in that case. And what we expect of our government is that in response, they will be neutral towards religion. In other words, we don't have a theocracy or we don't have a religious organization head like the Roman Empire used to have as our leader. We have a government that is run by the people. And so the people themselves never relinquish their First Amendment freedoms. They never relinquish their religious character. They bring that into the democratic process itself, and that's a great thing to have out there. the idea for the Founding Fathers was that these people would bring in their own faith teachings to the democratic process, and in that, virtue would rise to the top.
Right.
That they would allow the truth to come to the top through the robust debate we might have in our society as we debate upon the various finer points of our worldviews in trying to govern ourselves, that we would arrive at this understanding, this enlightened moment of what the truth actually is. I think sadly today, and I'll wrap it up by saying this, I think sadly today we've gone to the point where we no longer want to seek virtue in our government at all.
Right.
And so we don't have a passion to seek that ultimate big T, capital T truth in our world anymore. We just simply want to sit back and say, government, you guys figure it out. We're going to go back here and do whatever we do for our free time.
I think that's a great point. I mentioned earlier that I heard a speech by your CEO, Kelly Shackelford, and he made a point that I thought was a great point. He said that it's often not the majority that makes changes in a society. It's a determined minority. Jeremy, I think for those of us concerned about religious liberty, that there's two sides to that sword. Even though we may consider ourselves sometimes in a minority, we can make a difference. But by the same token, the other side doesn't sleep. And these people who I don't understand their motivations, perhaps you do always, that continually attack freedoms and win little battles here and there and chip to where, as you've already mentioned, a school teacher thinks it's illegal for a five-year-old to pray. And I just wonder what you think about that, or if you could perhaps expand on that a bit, the power a determined minority can have in our society.
Well, let's use that example of that case, the Perez case down in Orlando with that little girl trying to pray. You know, it was her dad who rightly called us and said, hey, how can we defend this, the rights of my little girl? Look, this is one of the bigger school districts in the country. They've got a lot of money. They've got a lot of attorneys that they can turn to, and they've got in-house attorneys. They've got out-of-house attorneys that they can turn to in the defense of their position. They've got pretty much unlimited taxpayer dollars to spend to try to put these people in their place. But it was one dad standing up and saying, no, my girl can pray for her lunchtime.
Right.
And that changed the course of things dramatically. Go south of there to Fort Lauderdale area in what is, I think, either the first or second geographically sized school districts in the country, the Broward County Public Schools down there, where we had Giovanni Rubio, who was a fifth grade student, who during a free reading period just wanted to read his Bible. He'd received a Bible from his church as a Christmas gift, and when it was free reading time, he decided to open it up and read it. And his teacher said, Gio, what are you reading? And he held up his Bible because he was kind of scared about what the teacher was going to think of it all. And she saw that it was a Bible. She said, you put that on my desk. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. And you got to understand that this had happened two or three times previously, and Gio had talked to his dad about it, and his dad had had a basic understanding that you're allowed to do this. And so he told him, if that happens again, make sure she gives me a call. So he said politely, my dad told me I can read this. If you've got a problem with him, you need to call him. Well, the teacher calls him to the front of the classroom, makes him dial the school phone right there in the classroom while his peers look on. She leaves this voicemail that you can listen to at libertyinstitute.org for his dad that says he's reading a book, a religious book, in my classroom. He cannot read that book in my classroom. And she wanted to get more understanding. Well, look, we sent a demand letter very quickly to the Broward County Public Schools, and they backed down. Giovanni Rubio is a fifth-grade young man. He is probably 5'2". He's a little guy. He's a minority, if you will.
Yeah.
He stood up against one of the biggest school districts in the country, and he won. All it takes for the triumph of religious liberty is young men and young women like Giovanni Rubio and Gabriela Perez standing up, graciously asserting the religious liberty and forcing the government to abide by the constitutional restraints that have been put upon them. That's it. When we stand up, we win. When we don't stand up, we lose.
Jeremy, you're right in the middle of this battle. How optimistic are you about our ability as concerned Americans to win these battles, to fight off these seemingly continual attacks on religious liberty?
I'm enormously optimistic, enormously so. Here's two reasons why. Number one, when we get involved in these cases, we win. We have a 99% win rate in the work that we do. In fact, we could lose a couple cases in our 99% win rate, which stay up there above 99%. So that's number one reason to be optimistic. We've got Michael Jordan-type attorneys that are working with us, like the former Solicitor General of the United States, Paul Clement. He's one of our volunteer attorneys, man. We win these cases. But secondly, I'm optimistic because in the end, the truth always wins. I've read the end of the book. You know, if I win in the courtroom, great, I win. If I lose in the courtroom, there's not a mind in this world that's dumb enough for me to convince of anything. But that's not my job. My job is to simply hold forth the truth, the reality of the law in our country, and what I believe is the big T truth in our worldview, and let other people conform to that. My job ultimately won't be to convince them. My job is to simply say, this is the Constitution, this is Scripture, conform your life to that.
Well, you are a passionate person about this, and I'm glad you're in the position that you're in, you and Mr. Shackelford, and I'm sure many others there with you, plus all the attorneys that you have sort of partnering with you all around the globe, really, around the country for certain, and doing this. And Jeremy, I'm just glad you guys are there. Just as a businessman, I'm glad you guys are out there fighting these battles. I think I would encourage those of you listening to go to libertyinstitute.org, donate some money to these folks, be familiar with them, and get them to fight for your liberties, religious and otherwise, because as we've talked about, you give up religious liberties, you give them all up. Kelly, you're a great guest. Thanks for having me. Well, Kelly, you're not Kelly, you're Jeremy. Jeremy, you're a great guest. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Maybe we can get Kelly on your show later on, too, but I appreciate it.
I was looking at a note here. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem. I love it.
Hey, thanks for being with us. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield, and we'll be back next week.